Before the family had even gotten Big Angel dressed, Little Angel was speeding off the freeway at Midway to hit Tower Records. He wanted to hear some Bowie. Ziggy Stardust always made it better. The Crown Vic had a CD slot. "Keep Your Electric Eye on Me, Babe." He and Lycia had cried every time that song played, and then they'd made love, and now Bowie was gone. Even if Tower wasn't open yet, he was willing to hang out in the parking lot and wait, but he couldn't find the record store anywhere. He drove past the sports arena. When they were kids, they'd called it the Sports Aroma. He pulled a U and rolled back. He never saw Tower. He drove down the long block slowly. People honked, but he didn't care. Tower was gone. That was some happy horse shit right there. Back on the freeway, but he wasn't going to be bested by this disappointing turn of events. He couldn't seem to find 91X on the radio. He headed south to Washington Street and sped up the slope toward Hillcrest. Off the record would ease his itch. Damn right, the best CD bins in town. But that was gone too. Someone had come into his memories and erased whole blocks with an invisible bulldozer. He rolled on to the empty parking lot where the Rip Van Winkle room used to stand. Alberto's Tacos was there now. He pulled in and just stared. His dad had once played piano in there for tips. Rip's Room, the hipsters had called it. The piano lounge was up a half set of carpeted stairs in red light. The whole place smelling of cigarettes and liquor and perfume and aquavelva. Little Angel's memory was echoing and ripe. Candied cherries, vanilla cokes, Patsy Cline on the juke when his dad was not tinkling red roses for a blue lady. Cocktail waitresses with lips the same color as the cherries, wafting clouds of white shoulders and musk oil, tracing Dad's back with their fingernails as they passed. He was there most Friday and Saturday nights, walking after midnight. I fall to pieces. Crazy. Little Angel never understood what those songs were about, but he sure understood what those red nails on Dad's back meant. Don Antonio, with his carefully pomaded hair and his dapper little Pedro Infante mustache, used Little Angel's charm to help him reel in waitresses and bowling wives and bored retirees looking for a night of passion. He trained Little Angel in the art of making women feel visible. If you teach a woman to feel like a work of art, you will make love to her every night. Uh-huh, Dad. Right. Got it. Dad gifted him with porno cocktail napkins, featuring cartoons of busty and idiotic farm girls romping in barns with salesmen. Why were these guys in barns wearing suits and little hats, he wondered. And tricky books of matches with naughty zingers built in, like the Rip Room's legendary Baby Bobby matchbook, wherein Baby Bobby could be observed on the cover fiddling between his legs with chubby fingers, and when Little Angel opened the cover, a single red-headed match in a little pink plastic tube popped out at him. A delighted Baby Bobby with arms outstretched in rapturous, erect joy. Little Angel was in fifth grade. Love is blue. Perfidia, the girl from Ipanema. The painted ladies loved him. He was like a little darling dog to them. They hugged him as he sat upon his stool, looking at Batman comics, their stout, encased breasts rolling across his cheeks, and he could smell the hot spaces beneath their arms. He tried to hide his personal Baby Bobby situation from them. A brandy snifter full of ones and fivers glistened on the piano. Swingers sent a steady stream of cocktails to the piano man. But by agreement with the barkeep, they were all ginger ale on the rocks. Who could play a lick after 15 Manhattans, let alone drive home? Dad split the overage the drinkers paid with the bartender. Nobody there knew it was his night job, that he spent all day cleaning up after bowlers, putting sanitary cakes in urinals, clearing the white tin bins in the ladies' room. At night, in a dapper cream smoking jacket, he did his Ricky Ricardo routine for drunk Americans. Slicked back hair, no wedding ring, and cigarettes. This was how Little Angel remembered his father. He sat there staring at the taco shop and wished he had learned how to smoke. Memories. Game for the losers. He had places to be. Too much time travel before 10 a.m. To hell with this, he said, and pulled out of the lot. He drove south again and blissed out on the glittering blue of the sea on one side, the epic sweep of the Coronado Bridge ahead, the dry hills across the freeway with huge jets dropping toward the airport like some invasion of gargantuan moths, and in the southern distance, always there, the mother of them all, the hills of Tijuana. Nobody went back there now, not even to visit their father's grave. The American, Big Angel called Little Angel. The assimilator. Little Angel has an American mother, not as classy as the women in the bar. Laughter, all eyes on him. Little Angel's job was to take it and smile. When Little Angel got as far south as National City, he still had hours to kill. His hotel was right off the mile of cars where the funeral home awaited. He shook his head. It was tawdry in a way that only the gnomes of his English department in Seattle would appreciate. How California, they'd say. How San Diego, though a couple of ironic eyeglasses and small brim hat types would call it Dago. How Latino, though nobody in his family had ever spoken Latin. Early check-in. Bags on the bed. Someone had left a crumpled tissue in the bathroom. It had lipstick on it. It reminded him of the cocktail waitresses. He was disturbed to find this vaguely erotic. They'd all be 80 now, or dead, those alarming women, in father's neon cocktail lounge in the sky. A maid came for the trash. Gracias, he said. She seemed startled that he spoke Spanish. When he stepped back outside and walked to the enormous car, it had begun to drizzle. Damn it, he thought. Big Angel broke my nose in that fist fight. He didn't realize until then that he'd been thinking about that fight the whole time. A week earlier, Big Angel's arrival at his mother's deathbed was the most heroic thing his wife had ever seen. This, after a lifetime of watching her flaco be a hero, and the old woman refused to accept it. Perla didn't like that old witch, but dying, well, that earned her several points. She knew how much the day had cost him. She could envision him walking back through all their history to be his mother's child one last time. He didn't talk to Perla about La Paz much. He was broody by nature, except when he was overtaken by good moods or feeling naughty. She still blushed at the memories after half a century. Oh, the things he did with her. Until he got sick. Even when he brooded, she knew when he was thinking about La Paz and his father and all the things that had happened back there. He just hung his head and stared at the floor. Now that he didn't smoke anymore, he drank many cups of black instant coffee and thought and ate too many sweets. Her thoughts were not of La Paz, but of coming north. It was the biggest decision she had ever made. And she relived that terrifying moment almost every day. It wasn't the trip that had been terrifying, or the destination. Rather, she had known that with this one step, she would join her fortunes to his, forever, risking everything. A romantic choice, yes, but also one that could have left her with nothing. She was already the mother of two fatherless boys. She didn't understand why her angel had taken to calling her his Perla of great price, when everyone in La Paz saw her as damaged goods, another silly girl used and forgotten by a man whose name she chose not to remember. She wanted to believe what Angel said, and yet she feared it was no more than his nature. She saw how he charmed and was charmed by other women, and she was frantic to keep him from their beds. She wasn't always sure what was real, only that she needed to be with him. There would be no going back home after this decision. She and the boys headed north before there was a modern highway. Her bigger boy, Indio, was a toddler, and Braulio was only a baby. It was one long bus ride that cost all the money she had. Rough roads, sometimes over dirt and boulders. The stops were at terrible taco shacks with outhouses, or gas stations with drooling, stinking toilets, much worse than outhouses. The people aboard the bus had brought their own food. She had carried a kilo of tortillas, a clay jug of water, and goat cheese. 4 days riding. South of Ensenada, police had set rocks across the road to stop the bus. They boarded and pointed their pistolas at the passengers and went through their bags. Perla had no money to offer. They ignored her boys, but they put their hands on her breasts. She looked out the window and held her breath and pushed them away with her mind. Angel's father would have stopped them, she told herself. She didn't have a father. She looked at them with her hateful stare. One day, you'll beg. The three policemen snagged a man by the arms and dragged him from the bus. They kicked at the doors to let the driver know he should leave. Nobody dared look back or listen to what the man was yelling. Everybody smelled by the end of the trip, and they were mortified. No Mexican wanted to smell like a barn animal. Tijuana was another world. Perla and her boys huddled outside the bus terminal on the north end of town, near the riverbed, in clouds of exhaust smoke. La Paz was all deserts and sea perched at the tip of Baja. It caught ocean breezes and crushing subtropical heat and hurricanes. She had cooked in her mother's restaurant, her sisters beside her, all slaves to the old woman. Her boys had grown up near the ferry terminals, watching huge white boats groan in from Mazatlan. They watched boys not much older sell chewing gum and trinkets to visitors. When the fishermen docked, children haggled for cheap crabs or begged for a tuna. Sometimes they swamped out the boats for sodas. Indio considered this training for his future. This was how he was going to care for his family. Sometimes he was able to bring his mother a bottle of Coca-Cola, and though they'd been hungry, it was home. But now they found themselves afraid and excited, as if Tijuana were El Dorado and all good things awaited them. It was loud and pushy, scary and tumble down, too bright, too colorful. Berla's overwhelming impression of Tijuana was twofold, symphonies of noise and endless swirls of dust, and stringy street dogs. All of the same stumpy build, the same yellow-red-tinged fur, the same black patches of bare skin, all of them moving through traffic with insouciance, like dancers or bullfighters, seeming to bounce off the bumpers of old Buicks and under the two-tone city buses called burras, but bobbing out of the dust clouds again and hopping onto curbs unharmed, where they stretched out in the sun and slept with flies in their eyes. Perhaps the most amazing thing about Tijuana was what they never imagined, the unexpected gringos. Downtown Tijuana was an endless parade of towering, noisy, apparently rich Americans. Perla was astonished to realize the kids were already learning English. That was something she did not expect. She remembered how Big Angel chose to go hungry so everyone could have a tiny bit of food, even if it was only a mouthful. He'd divide his portion among her sons. That's when they had taken to calling each other Flaco and Flaca. They would never be that thin again. Sometimes he brought candy for her two boys, though she scolded him. Perla, he said, life is sour enough. Let them enjoy this. That first Christmas, he bought the boys a bike to share and bought her a new dress. She had knitted him a sweater, and even though it was hot that year, he wore it every day. Big Angel was her hero. She did not know his heroism was fueled by fuming rage. He fought anyone who insulted her or her children. He even fought off his own family's rebukes and married her, then snuck them into the United States when it became obvious that only hunger and dirt and rats and evil police waited for them in the poorest of the colonias where they could afford to live. Perhaps his biggest mistake was his believing that rage could help him be the perfect father. It was really all he knew about being a father. On some days it almost worked. But Perla was so afraid of losing what she had won that she became more strident in her defense of her man, insisting to the boys that Angel was always right, even when she knew he wasn't. And the boys' occasional bruises told them otherwise as well. It fell hardest on Indio, the oldest, the one who had been his mother's protector and defended her honor in the streets of La Paz, scrounged for food, done odd jobs, and still remembered his birth father. Indio, the older brother who found himself usurped and then disciplined, began a lifelong resistance Big Angel could never overcome. Families came apart and regrouped, she thought, like water. In this desert, families were the water. Poor Mother America. Big Angel's sister, Marilu, had watched over the old woman at the hospital. Perla's sister, La Gloriosa, had helped. Retired women themselves, they were called the girls by all the older women. The younger women called them auntie, whether they were their aunts or not. That was the rule in Mexican families. All older women were your tía or your nina. They had presided over mother's hallucinations in those hours of her dissolution. She saw dead friends and dead relatives and angels and Jesus Christ, and she greeted them and extended her hand to them, and laughed with them. The sisters-in-law believed this was really happening, or one of them did. The other didn't believe anything, but was willing to debate it. Besides, Mother was completely blind and half-deaf, so how could she be seeing or hearing anything? She kept misunderstanding the script of their daily lives. She was confused by the plastic clip from the heart monitor that was clamped to her forefinger, like a laundry pin. She mistook it for the handle of a coffee cup and repeatedly raised it to her dry lips and sipped as if her favorite instant coffee had recently been served by a polite waitress. Gracias, she said to the air and slurped her invisible brew. They just shook their heads. They had to get Big Angel to her bedside. This would be a major operation, akin to military maneuvers, just getting him onto a toilet. Required strong backs and strong noses. Getting him dressed was a nightmare of clenched teeth and gangly limbs, everybody terrified of some shattered bone or wrenched shoulder blade. Brother had his own problems, pues. They knew better than anyone, they told themselves. Of course, everyone told themselves this. That was the funny thing about a lingering death. Everybody attached to the spectacle wanted to accrue mastery of the mystery, own it without actually dying, especially anyone who wiped the afflicted's bottom. But Big Angel's wife felt that she knew better than anyone, as did his daughter and his son and his pastor. Everybody had been worn down by death. Everybody had an opinion. Call him. You call him. No me gusta. It's too sad. It's creepy calling him. You are bad, bad, bad. I never said I was good. Don't be a stupid. They had presided over Big Angel's last three death scenes, from which he had unexpectedly resurrected and returned home, more arrogant than ever. But now he was carved down to the size of a child and not able to walk more than 10 steps, and those while leaning on his walker. True, his son had affixed a bike horn to it and to his wheelchair, so Big Angel could make auga sounds to amuse himself, but it was a diminishment of the patriarch for sure. Only little kids and cholos laughed. They called Big Angel's house and began the major production of getting that branch of the family to rouse him and clean him and dress him and roll him out. Big Angel was wheeled into the waiting room by Perla, who wanted to be anywhere but there. Hospitals horrified her. She had been in too many. She didn't like Big Angel's old spice, but she had never told him that. In her mind, it mixed with the hospital smells. He felt he looked excellent. Only Minnie knew enough to think he looked like the guy in his giant suit in the old Talking Heads videos. The family is all seated, muttering over the insectile buzz of a game show on TV, coffee in cardboard cups. He announced in his new little reedy voice, "I will not let Mama see me like this." His hands were shaking. His ankles, where they peeked out from under his trouser cuffs, looked like chicken bones. He was biting down on his own agony, and he rose from his chair, struggling, grunting with effort, grinning like a maniac with sheer fury, and he refused the aluminum walker. It hurt so much the watchers felt it. They leaned toward him, but checked themselves from reaching out to help him. His trousers and white shirt fit him like billowing tents. He wiped the tear out of his eye and staggered into her room under his own power. A feathery hug for Marilu, a longer hug for La Gloriosa. He breathed in the scent of her hair, but he didn't look at her. His eyes were on the small creature that was his mother. He walked to her bed and bent to her as if bowing. He took her hand and spoke. "Mother, I have come." "What?" she said. He talked louder. "Mother, I have come."
"Qué?"
"Madre," he shouted. "Aquí estoy."
"Ay, hijo," she scolded. "I never taught you to be so rude. What's the matter with you?"
And then she died. He had done his duty, had met with his mother's priest ahead of time, slipping him a check for his services. They didn't like each other. Big Angel knew this nasty little priest didn't approve of him. There had been rumors. Big Angel had possibly slept with all his wife's sisters. That's what the gossipers in the parish said. And Big Angel's father may have done the same. And nobody ever went to confession. Rumor had it Big Angel was a Protestant, or a Mormon, or a Freemason, possibly a Rosicrucian, or a Jesuit, or all the above. Big Angel didn't approve of the priest's teeth. The other thing he railed against after Mexican time and lame excuses was bad teeth. Mexicans could not afford bad teeth if they expected gringos to take them seriously. And gold teeth didn't help, though Mexicans thought they looked like rich people with gold in their mouths. This priest had teeth like a rat. They made him whistle a little when he talked, and when he really got going, he sprayed like a little lawn sprinkler. After slipping Big Angel's check into his pocket, the priest admonished, "Don't be late. I'm a busy man." "Late," Big Angel said. "How can you suggest such a thing?"
"You know how you Mexicans are."
A small rodent's smile, a jocular little punch to the shoulder. Big Angel rolled out of the sacristy, fuming. Gracias a Dios. 1 p.m. He never knew when the memory would intrude. The crunch of the club hitting the man on the side of the head. How it hurt his wrist. He hadn't meant to kill anybody. Sometimes it jerked him from sleep. Sometimes he shook his head violently and said no during a TV show or a breakfast, and everybody thought it was just Pops being Pops. He fiercely rubbed his temples now to drive it away, and the smell of the gas on his hands, he was certain the others could smell it, the whoosh of the flames still audible a lifetime later. "We are late," he announced, again. Everybody was getting tired of his bitching. It was his own damn fault. Big Angel knew this. It had started in his bladder at first, and he had told no one about the blood in his urine. If he hadn't passed out one morning, they would not have discovered the tumors. Still, he had beat it back. Minor surgery, snipping the little bastards out like grapes, sticking a long probe up his urethra. His father had taught him to be stoic. Pain was how a man measured his worth, so he didn't flinch during the probes, and he was asleep for the rest. And suddenly, the little grape bundles of tumors were gone, until they grew a crop in his belly. X-rays and MRIs and needles and poisons in his arm, followed by poison pills and pills that smelled like rotten fish and radiation. His reward? Spots on his lungs. He cursed every cigarette, cursed himself. And then his bones withered. The chemicals and the inserted metal going up his urethra and the radiation had shrunk it all, until it hadn't. "You won't die of the cancer, per se," Dr. Nagel told him at their last conference. "It'll be a systemic collapse. Kidneys will go, heart, or you'll get pneumonia. Your will is strong, but your body is worn out." "How long?" "Prediction? A month?" That was 3 weeks ago. He smiled as if he'd won the lottery when the nurse wheeled him out. Perla, with her eyes red and watery with worry, Minnie wringing her hands and twisting the ends of her hair in her fingers, and Lalo, stoic and hiding tears of mourning behind his shades. All believed Big Angel smile because they needed to, because they had always believed him, because he was the law. "Flaco," Perla said, "what did they say?" "Well," he said, "I'm sick, but we all know that." "But you're cool, Pops?" "Of course, Lalo. I told you I was fine." Minnie hugged him and made him feel like her hair was smothering him. "It could be worse," he told Perla. "How?" she cried. "At least I don't have hemorrhoids." She would have smacked his arm, but she'd seen how quickly he bruised, and she never smacked him anymore. He was tired of shouting at what was inside his body. His wrath was spilling out on the toxic landscape all around him. Somebody had killed him. He thought it was his wife's cooking. He thought it was the coating on the frying pan. He thought it was the trials his family put him through. Salsa or beef, DDT. He thought it was the mile-high pastrami sandwiches he could not avoid no matter how he tried. He thought it was Mexican Pepsi with salt peanuts in it. The clock. Time, you bastard. Or God. He struck the back of the driver's seat, but his punch was too weak for his son to feel. "Don't get excited, Daddy," Minnie said from behind, rubbing his shoulders. He jerked out of her grasp. "Minerva," he shouted, "you're hurting me. Vultures, all of you." She wept silently for the 100th time, but only one tear. "To hell with this." His wife sighed. His son blew a bubble of chewing gum full of cigarette smoke. He held his ciggy out a crack in the window. Big Angel watched the smoke whip away. He squeezed his eyes shut and tried to remember the things his friend Dave had told him. Gratitude, meditation, prayer, attention to the small things, which were paradoxically eternal. He reminded himself that soul resided in family and relationships, not in good times, but also in bad. The soul in potting plants and eating breakfast, Dave said. What a bunch of lies, he decided. God damn it, he said. He apologized to God for taking his name in vain. But really, the minivan still had miles to go, and the clock never stopped ticking. The fam had rented out the Bavarian chalet of Rest Funeral Home on the mile of cars. Honda and Dodge dealerships in the distance. All the dads in the family arrived at the parlor and craned their necks to look at the candy-colored ranks of Challengers and Chargers sitting in the lots as they drove up. The young'uns and shorties were scoping the Honda lots for fast and furious road rockets. Neither generation wanted to drive the clunkers their elders had driven. People loitered at the double doors. They had buried Braulio through this place, and Grandpa Antonio. They had a relationship with it. It was their tradition. They felt oddly at home here, and chipper in some inexplicable way. Regular attendees knew where the coffee urns were, and the cardboard cups and whitening powders. It was like their own Disneyland of death. Outside on the main drag, a half block from the driveway, a watcher lurked. The legendary Indio. Alone, dressed all in white, his arms were muscular, and he had a tribal tattoo of hummingbirds and vines on his left biceps. Aladdin Sane on the other. A line of Bowie lyric down that arm. Throw me tomorrow. Across his left collarbone above his heart, a name he had never explained and had no intention of explaining. Sweet Melissa. That was the problem with these people, Indio thought. They didn't ever let anybody have a secret. But they were hiding things from one another every day of their lives. Little Angel had given him that Bowie record 100 years ago. From his choker, a single black enameled feather dangled. He slouched in a white Audi A6 with a pearl paint finish. The car's interior was all ebony. His shiny black hair spilled over his shoulders and down his chest, and he crept along the block with Curtis Mayfield's pusher man on the deck, watching them through $1,200 sunglasses. He hadn't seen many of these people in years, not since Braulio's funeral. Well, he'd seen his mother, Mom's and Minnie. Somebody had to make sure their hair was presentable. He had a good facial man who kept them fresh, waxed away those sideburns Mom's had started growing. It was their secret. It irritated him that the family kept acting like Braulio had been some teenager when he died. Fucker had already served in the army, for God's sake. He'd been 35. They diminished the boys even in death. He blamed them all for being so stupid. Damn, there went Tio Cesar, the middle uncle. Dude was tall. He hadn't remembered how tall Cesar was. And his notorious wife, as tall as he was. They seemed like giants among hobbits. She was some Mexico City chilanga. He'd never really talked to her, so he didn't care who liked her and who didn't. He knew they didn't like her. Minnie had told him. They didn't like outsiders anyway. The family suspected everybody of being an invader. He didn't like most of the family, to be honest. He didn't see either one of the angels. Cabrones, he said aloud. He revved the engine. It snarled like some jungle cat just the way he liked it. He wasn't about to join them. He ripped into a U-turn and vanished north. 1:20 p.m. The big Crown Victoria slouched at the back of the parking lot. The funeral home had a fake Germanic facade and stood across the street from a taco shop, a gas station, and a Starbucks. The street smelled of carne asada. The stained glass windows were plastic. Pigeons flocked all about the alpine roofline, moving neurotically from palm tree to mortuary to taqueria and back again, frantic that one of them might have found an onion ring that had been overlooked by the others. Little Angel got out of the car and walked into the building. Inside, the family was arranging flower wreaths, some of which looked like displays for championship high school marching band competitions. Banners with glitter spelling out condolences. Pictures of Mama America in better years stood on easels around the central altar. What a babe, one of the grandsons said. They all smiled. The girls had hot-glued white styrofoam and feathered doves to the frames of the pictures. It was quite lovely, everyone thought. Little Angel sipped his skinny caramel latte and tried to look comfortable in his sports jacket and black tie. Women he didn't remember hugged him and left smudges of makeup on his lapels. Love and sorrow wafted across the chapel like perfume. So did the perfume. He didn't see Minnie. He watched for La Gloriosa. No sign of his big brother either, whom he was scared to see. The funeral director hid in his back office watching golf on his phone. He paused it and stirred himself and came out and plugged in a laptop that started playing a slideshow of Mama's life to a soundtrack of her favorite singer, Pedro Infante. The pictures began to cycle through. Big Angel as a boy, some weird little black dogs, babies, old houses with flower vines on the walls, a desert, Big Angel and Marilu and Cesar as jug-eared kids with thick eyebrows and skinny bellies, more kids in black and white photos taken with a brownie camera, a motorcycle, a filthy fishing boat, a stack of clam and oyster shells taller than the children. No pictures of Don Antonio. Mourners started to file in, stunned by the extravagance of the funeral the family had arranged and looking around for Big Angel. 45 minutes of embraces and ostentatious arrivals and all the siblings arranging themselves in the front row and the rings of descendants like shock waves of a meteor strike radiating back through the room. Paz, the controversial Chilanga sister-in-law, cast angelic glares of disdain at everybody she felt was not dressed properly. She watched them as she spread gold lamé sheets over the altar. Cesar's third trophy wife, dressed in leopard spots and her hair in a fancy spiky bob with purple tips. Little Angel stepped up to him, and they embraced. "My sexiest brother," Cesar said, and reached back to grab Little Angel's ass. Little Angel looked around to make sure nobody saw that. This seemed inappropriate on so many levels. Paz sneered. "Happy to see you too, carnal," Little Angel said. Paz stared at him. He had aged, but not enough. He thought he was so special, living with hippie gringos far away. No troubles at all. Why would he age? Though he had some gray showing at his temple, she was happy to see. And Cesar, squeezing his brother's ass, he'd hit on a hole in the ground if he thought there was a gopher in it. "Let go of my butt," Cesar's sad face crinkled into its first smile in 7 days. "Did you miss me?" he said. "Always." Cesar watched Little Angel as his eyes roamed the crowd. He looked at every face, as if he didn't know any of them. He was exactly like Big Angel, Cesar thought, always watching. Grandchildren were holding obstreperous great-grandchildren on their hips. Americanized teen chicks lurked around the far edges, looking at their cell phones. Everybody had dressed up as best they could, except one old knucklehead in a Hawaiian shirt and shorts. Big Sister Marilu came into the room somber and elegant in her black dress. Little Angel loved her smell. She was all Chanel No. 5. Hugs, air kisses. "Baby brother," she said, everybody speaking English. "Is everybody coming?" he asked. "Por sure. Even el indio?" They looked at the doors as if he'd appear. "It's complicated," she said. The awkward pause felt long enough for a dandelion to germinate. Finally, Little Angel said, "Where's the patriarch?" She looked at her tiny rectangular watch with utter ferocity. "They must be making him late." There seemed to be a sadistic satisfaction in her smirk, like the face of a teacher who had just caught a kid cheating on his pop quiz. She took Little Angel's hand and led him to the pew. They formed a little line there, brother, sister, brother, and Paz, who was Marilu's greatest enemy on earth. Each of the women elaborately ignored the other. Cesar nobly constructed a border between them with his body. Marilu opened her pocketbook and produced clear mint lifesavers. Little Angel accepted one and a folded Kleenex just in case. He took a small notebook out of his pocket and clicked his pen. "You're going to write?" she said. "Now?" "No." He leaned into her and showed her the pages. "I'm taking notes. I don't know who anybody is. It's my cheat sheet." "Bas," it said, surrounded by black circles. A squiggly line extended to Cesar. On the facing page, Cesar's exes were in their own circles, with outriders radiating, various kids, a grandkid or two. These were fractal pages. Marilu made the family's I-know-what-you-mean face.
Mm-hmm, she intoned. Tell me about it.
She tapped the offspring page. You missed Marco.
Who's Marco?
Satan.
Cesar leaned around his sister and held his fingers straight up from the top of his head.
Here, he said. Es mi hijo.
Little Angel added Marco to the pattern with erect hair atop the little circle. Meanwhile, the priest in full regalia skulked behind the curtain at the front of the room like Liberace. He checked his watch. He didn't care if Big Angel was there or not. He burst forth exactly on time, raising his arms and cracking a toothsome grimace. He seemed to lack a theme song. He began shouting straight away as though demons were being blown out the back windows. He pointed above the heads of the mourners toward the distant and blessed greeny shires of heaven. He ignored the siblings and their children, firing his evangelical rockets over them. People were shaking their heads and wondering, "Is he yelling at me?" They had seen this before. Lately, it seemed Mexican funerals were being reimagined as last-ditch chances to terrorize the survivors into converting. It had happened at Don Antonio's service and had disrupted Braulio's funeral as well.
"We mourn Doña America," he said. "We miss Mama America. You all claim to love her. Then why have more of your family not come to her service? Nearly 100 years old and the rest of you are what? Watching television?"
The general thought among the mourners was a version of, "Oh, shit." The priest was revved up like some kind of Elysian dragster, about to pull religion wheelies all the way down the track. They were in for it now, with no way to get out.
"She gave you nearly 100 years of motherly sacrifice. Good mother, good grandmother, good Catholic, good neighbor. The lines of mourners should be out the door. Shame, shame, shame."
Well, he wasn't wrong. Big Angel's minivan was just pulling up outside.
"Ahora sí," he said.
He rubbed his hands. Lately, his anger often manifested itself in a wicked good mood. The shorter his time on Earth, the more convinced he was that he was invincible. If only everything would comply with his plans. What was it Little Angel had said when he was in college, reading all those European books? Hell is other people. Meds worked all right, but his own ability to outsmart and outmaneuver everyone and everything, even death, was his secret superpower. Screw death. Dying was for worms and chickens, not angels. Bone cancer? He had found herbs and minerals that would make bones rebuild like coral reefs. Vitamin C, vitamin D, vitamin A, chaga tea. Tumors in his organs? Turmeric. Selenium, by golly. "I am invincible," he told himself. "I am not invisible." Even in his wheelchair, Big Angel believed he could kick the ass of anything that came at him, and everybody else believed it too. They needed it to be true, even when the kids thought they were fooling him by lying about some ghastly eruption of malfeasance and moral rot. They secretly relied on his infallibility. Big Angel would always catch them, but he would forgive. "I am the patriarch," he told himself for the 1,000th time, as they wrestled him out of the minivan and got him folded into his chrome chariot. That made him so mad, he smiled at his wife and son and daughter. It scared them all. He heard the wails coming through the door in florid Spanish.
"Mother America wanted nothing more than to keep you out of hell, you generation of vipers."
What kind of squawking was this?
"Jesus Christ," Big Angel pointed at the double doors of the chapel as if leading a cavalry charge.
He sure as hell had them bang open the doors as loudly as possible. He directed them to roll him down the aisle, front and center. He was taking over. After all, he was named Miguel Ángel. Who else in the family was named after the archangel Michael? He wished he had a flaming sword. God damn it. Sorry, God. His smile grew wider. He was pretty well persuaded that he could outsmart God, too. Perla leaned into the chair and kept him moving. Hungry Man marched behind, bearing the walker. Big Angel made plenty of noise. He coughed. He kicked his footrests a couple of times so they clattered, adding to the percussive cadence. Poor Minnie stared at the floor and tried not to laugh. Oh, no. There was Uncle Little Angel. No way. No way was she going to look at him. She would pee herself laughing if he looked at her. Everybody was turning around. She avoided Little Angel's eyes. Big Angel let his left brow rise and gave them his most ironic glare, letting them know that the sheriff was back in town. The kids and grandkids called him Pops, and that magic word flowed down the gathered clan. Here comes Pops. Pops in the house. Check it. Pops is low riding. The elder members of the family never failed to marvel at the attitude of the kids, how Big Angel was a rolling laugh riot to them, arbiter of bad jokes, spiritual insight, ice cream money, and shelter when they were bounced out of their houses or were let out of jail or rehab or needed to come in off the streets at midnight. He nodded to them, making eye contact with every single one of them, and raised one finger at his favorites, which seemed to each person to be her or himself. "Go slow, flaca," he told his wife. "Roll me right down the middle. Go slow." "Ay, flaco," she said softly. "Don't make a scene. Just watch me, Perla." She shook her head and smiled at the gathered faces. "I am married to a willful man," she was telling them all with her eyes. He was as fierce as a falcon in his chair. He could smell the priest's breath shooting up the aisle like a secret weapon. Big Angel, pointing at his 1,000 nephews and granddaughters and children. His brothers and sisters were the old generation now, sitting in a grim line up front, all of them looking at Mama's urn and realizing the same thing. At the same moment, we are now the oldest generation, and we are the next to die. They looked back and were shocked at Big Angel's appearance, even though they saw him daily. Big Angel craned around in his chair to nod at Perla's sisters. There was steadfast Lupita with her American husband, Uncle Jimbo, in shorts. And there she was, La Gloriosa, as tragic and magnificent as he had ever seen her. He couldn't remember her real name, just her nickname. He couldn't remember if he had ever heard her real name. She had always been the Glorious One, alone, lost, as always, in the cool meadows of her own thoughts, shiny black hair with a supernatural silver streak spilling down the left side of her face. Her shades were impenetrably black. He didn't know if she was looking at him or not. Her hands smelled like warm, sweet spices. He thought of the side of her neck. Orange peel, lemongrass, mint, cinnamon. She nodded slightly. He looked away. Perla watched this. She had been noting their shenanigans for decades. She squinted at her sister. La Gloriosa made a ¿qué? Face back at her. Big Angel was excited to see his youngest brother sitting in the front row. The great lost soul, English teacher, who had gone off to Seattle and lived in the rain. Big Angel felt like he had built his little brother from some kind of model kit. Little Angel, his namesake. "I broke my little brother's nose, and it felt good." Little Angel sat at the far end of the sibling row and grinned at his big brother. Big Angel waved at Little Angel. He could raise his hand only a few inches off the armrest, but he held it up as if giving a benediction. Little Angel whispered to his sister, Maria Luisa,
Hey, Lulu, Big Brother has become the Pope of Tijuana. Everybody still called her Mary Lou. It had been so kicky in 1967, when she wore go-go boots and pinned falls in her hairdo. She had never worn jeans or a t-shirt. She used to have a bright pink rat-tail comb and a jar of some hairstyling phlegm called dippity-doo. Even seated, Brother Cesar was taller than the rest. Everyone joked that Mother must have had a secret lover because nobody could explain his size. His Valkyrie wife sat on his far side making sour faces. Poor Cesar was utterly crushed by his mother's death. He was 67 and his mother had still ironed his shirts for him. She had given him a chocolate orange every Christmas, always had menudo for him, and her old Spanish Reader's Digests. Being without her made him feel like a child lost in a rainstorm. His hands shook. He could not even consider the details of his big brother's illness. He reached out for Big Angel's hand. Their fingers touched. Big Angel's were as cold as the grave. Cesar clenched his own hands and held them before his lips. The priest, sensing his grip on the crowd slipping away, suddenly shouted, "Sinners, buy 10 million condoms for Mardi Gras every year!" If Mama America were alive, she would have slapped him for talking about condoms in front of her urn. The two angels locked eyes and started to laugh. The wheelchair loomed in the aisle between the front pews about a foot from the priest. "Aquí estoy," Big Angel announced, settling a little more comfortably in his chair. The priest stopped and stared at him. "Carry on," Big Angel said. "I give you permission." He opened and closed his skinny legs and held his hands in his lap. "Go on." The good father collected himself. Big Angel smiled like St. Francis. He gestured impatiently, tapped his watch. "You're on Mexican time, padre. We're working people. Vámonos, pues." "I gave up television," the priest preached, "for 40 days. Not because I had to, because I wanted to offer it up as a sacrifice." He was catching his stride again. "Protestants want to take away our saints, our blessed statues, our virgin, and they want to have unmarried sex. Sodomy is the law of the land, and you, the cursed generation, turn from God and the values of your matriarch who rests before you now. The least you could do is sacrifice. Si, mi pueblo, sacrifice TV." He held up his hand. "Our Lord and Savior demands a sacrifice. Sacrifice your favorite television programs." "Chingado," Big Angel said, looking around at his family. "There goes Ice Road Truckers." They strangled on laughter. Little Angel had to lean on his big sister's shoulder. "Shh," she and Cesar said. Marilu was still a good Catholic girl. Sort of. She covered her mouth with her hanky and guffawed. "You're bad," she whispered. Minnie sat behind Little Angel. "Daddy for the win," she said. He looked back at her, and the look in his eyes said, "He always wins." And her look said, "You know it." "Amen," the priest finally choked out, and he flew through the fake satin curtain beside the altar. Big Angel said, "Now the family will speak for itself." Nobody was ready to give a eulogy, but El Patriarca had commanded them. One by one, they came forward and spoke what poetry each could muster. He sat with his hands folded over his tiny belly, nodding and smiling and laughing. But he never wept. 3 p.m. "Oh, my mother," Big Angel said. He had failed her. He knew he had. He had failed in so many ways, at so many things. Mother, father, Mazatlan and the Bent family, Braulio, Indio. But it had taken a while to get control of the ship. There had been mistakes. "Captains are not born," he told himself. "They are made." He wasn't yet convinced, however. But Mother, he felt that she had not respected his beloved Perla, and he had let her fade into the background of his life. He liked to think that a Mexican mother would respect a man who stood by his wife.
He didn't count on the rules set by this Mexican mother. No dissension ever. No disobedience. So they had been cordial with each other. Still, when she came for a visit, she would have some terrorist act in her bag of tricks. She would wander into the kitchen and somehow get into the cabinet so she could say in a conversationally mild tone, "You'd think these pots and pans would be brighter. Maybe they're old, not just dingy." Or a helpful note that Perla should scrub coffee cups, not just rinse them. Big Angel had not physically cuddled his mother like his brother Cesar had. Hell, even Little Angel had hugged her more than he had. Cesar ended up sleeping on her couch after each marriage ended. She had still done his laundry and packed him lunches for work. "Every son," he told himself, "will suffer after his mother has gone and he realizes how little he thanked her." "I'm nobody special," he said. "Just a husband, a father, a working man. I wanted to change the world. There was no one there." Big Angel was turning 70. It seemed very old to him. At the same time, it felt far too young. He had not intended to leave the party so soon. "I have tried to be good," he told his invisible interviewer. His mother had made it to the edge of 100. He had thought he'd at least make it that far. In his mind, he was still a kid, yearning for laughter and a good book, adventures and one more albóndiga soup cooked by Perla. He wished he had gone to college. He wished he had seen Paris. He wished he had taken the time for a Caribbean cruise because he secretly wanted to snorkel. And once he got well, he would go do that. He was still planning to go see Seattle, see what kind of life his baby brother had. He suddenly realized he hadn't even gone to the north side of San Diego, to La Jolla, where all the rich gringos went to get suntans and diamonds. He wished he had walked on the beach. Why did he not have sand dollars and shells? The sand dollar suddenly seemed like a very fine thing to have. And he had forgotten to go to Disneyland. He sat back in shock. He had been too busy to even go to the zoo. He could have smacked his own forehead. He didn't care about lions, tigers. He wanted to see a rhinoceros. He resolved to ask Minnie to buy him a good rhino figure. Then wondered where he should put it. By the bed. Damn right. He was a rhino. He'd charge at death and knock the hell out of it. Lalo had tattoos. Maybe he'd get one, too. When he got better. People filed out. Cousins hugging cousins. Big abrazos. He was taking inventory. In his mind, a spreadsheet. He repented of one sin per day, and he moved it to the other column marked paid. On this day, he repented that he had ever loved eating sea turtle soup, sopa de caguama. How rich it was, with lime and cilantro, fresh rolled corn tortillas with salt in them to catch a bit of broth, and some chile. He didn't like chile, really, but his father had taught him a man ate chile until he broke out in a sweat. It was supposed to prevent cancer. Old Don Antonio had sneezed every time he ate it, sneezed until he turned purple, but he went back for more. Suffering had been his religion. Big Angel shook his head, but his tongue wiggled from just thinking of that soup. Now all he really wanted was to simply swim with the turtles and beg their forgiveness for finding their flippers so delicious for so long. "Lot of troubles," he said, "y muchos cabrones." He observed them all from the short watchtower of his chair. There were days when he could not recall any sins at all. On these days, he thought he might be through with all his transgressions. Clear. But he was a smart man. Too smart to fall for his own tricks. There was always another sin drifting in the shadows, waiting to alight and sting the heart. When Minnie stopped to check on him, he said, "Mija, a rhino has such thick skin, mosquitoes and flies can't bite him. They bend their beaks on him." How nice, she said. 3:30 p.m. Home for a minute. He had to get his diaper changed before the burial. Poor Minnie, he thought.